Tonight on Arena, Family Romance LLC, The Old Guard and Blackwater Abyss are the movies up for review, and Paul Fahey on what should be happening at the Galway International Arts Festival today. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we start with our film reviews on this Thursday evening. First up is Family Romance LLC, Werner Herzog's tale of a real Japanese company which hires out its staff to play fake friends and relatives. You may have heard the director speaking to us on last night's programme. Next up will be The Old Guard, an action thriller starring Charlize Theron as the leader of a band of immortal warriors who find themselves on the run from Big Pharma and the CIA. And finally, Blackwater Abyss, a low-budget croc horror film set in Australia. Joining me here in studio, Sir Taff McGuire, Stephen Boyd, down the line. There's only one place to start with this week, and that's Werner Herzog and Family Romance LLC. It's an amazing premise, which is based on a real-life company called Family Romance,
yeah,
Sarah.
And companies as well. Mm. It's not just the one. So we have this head of the company who's been around for 10 years, Ishii. So he is a real person, Ishii Yuchi, and he also plays himself, but in a drama by Werner Herzog, where about 85% of what happens is made up. And it is indeed a drama. It has a clear documentary feel throughout. And with it being a drama rather than a documentary, we're able to explore all sorts of possible limitations or how far we can push people acting as family members, as mourners, and we're able to see and therefore think about what roles we ourselves might play when we're in these various roles.
The basic setup here, Stephen, I suppose, is the father-daughter or the fake father and daughter relationship that's at the very heart of the story.
Yeah, absolutely. This kind of really strange but quite sensitive and emotional strand at the heart of the film. So at the beginning of the film, we see Yuchi playing this kind of tender father to a 12-year-old girl called Mahiro at the Festival of the Cherry Blossoms. But, you know, in the next scene, we realize that Yuchi's actually been hired by that girl's mother to play the role of the father I'm not sure if we know what happened to him, but he disappeared after 16 months or so of the young girl's life. And this kind of touching strand, which is kind of repulses you a little bit at the beginning, draws you in to the point where Yuchi becomes this hugely empathetic character. And he himself starts to kind of love this girl as if she is his daughter, and vice versa. And it's hugely strange and beguiling and touching. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah, and Stephen mentions there, Sarah, that, you know, he starts finding himself really getting to build a relationship. When we say falling in love with it, falling in love in a father-daughter type of way. And there's a kind of a little tension between the mother and the fake father as well.
Yeah.
But how does Herzog was adamant with me last night that he wasn't attempting to blur the boundaries, that this is a fiction and that's that, but it is hard sometimes to get what's the difference between fact and fiction.
Absolutely. This is something that Ishii was really agonised about. You know, that's the point at which the film really starts to unravel, when he as a person sort of breaks down, is like, well, are my relationships real? So, I mean, the questions that he's going through and the things that he's thinking about and wondering are legitimate questions to have when this is a thing that exists. I mean, it's not just the father-daughter thread is sort of the emotional, this is, gives a gravitas and sort of, you know, this is the hook upon which we hang other possibilities. But there are many other possibilities explored. Someone's hired as a mourner. Someone is hired to take a verbal tongue lashing for letting the train be 20 seconds late.
I loved that particular
one. It was great.
Yeah, it's this guy in the
really
train station. Yeah, he's in the train station and he's allowed the train to go 20 seconds early, in fact, which is a huge problem in
disgrace.
Terms of the knock-on
disgrace.
Effect.
Front pages about having to apologise, all that sorts of things. But there are loads of those moments. There are ones where there's a woman who hires people to pretend a paparazzi to elevate her public profile, and it works.
And another woman who's a lottery.
And there's another lady, I think.
Go ahead, Stephen.
Yeah, I think, sorry, Sean, I was just going to say the same thing, who's a lottery winner and wants that feeling again. So she hires Family Romance LLC to come and, you know, arrive at her door with some cheerleaders as if she's won something again. You know, she hasn't won anything. It's amazing.
Yeah, and there's a kind of a sadness in that as well, it has to be said. But this is classic Herzog territory, Stephen, really, isn't it? The back catalogue is full of films that where what's real and what is fake are hard. It's hard to tell them apart.
Yeah, like it's hard to encapsulate Herzog in a sentence or in a certain aesthetic, but something that's there throughout his whole all in the last 50 years is this strange combination sometimes between drama and documentary, fiction and non-fiction, real life and fantasy. I mean, like, there's so many examples of that stand out from the 90s. Little Dieter Needs to Fly, that great documentary about the German World War II pilot, who he kind of gets to enact his own capture in Vietnam, and then he remakes it as a Hollywood film with Christian Bale as that character. So yeah, that's something that Herzog does brilliantly throughout his whole career, and this is the same. It's very, very hard to detach yourself from this, and as if it is a fiction, it really does feel like you're watching something that has only slightly been twisted, but it probably has been twisted quite a bit.
Yeah, you have to be patient with it, though, I think, Sarah. It's safe to say the opening 10 to 15 minutes, when you're not sure what the relationship is between the father daughter, it's quite a slow watch.
Yeah, and you really have to become comfortable with being uncomfortable. There's a huge sense of unease throughout the film, where, you know, people are being hired, and you're obviously concerned about the ethics of this. You know, at what point do these relationships end? Is it really okay to have someone stand in as your father? All those kinds of things abound. As well as that, like, there are just some very strange moments that are unrelated to the plot points we had mentioned that really add actually nothing to the story. So I'm thinking of one instance where there's a 3-year-old child who accompanies Mihiro and Ishiyushi, her father, for a whole day. And you're like, where are the parents? And that's something you just have to become comfortable with. And a lot of these side stories about the individual instances and the potential for these companies just really add nothing. So if you were from the beginning ready to ponder, open-minded, and like, right, I'm going to think about all the possibilities and various acting roles we play in life, then it'll be enjoyable. If you're here for just like pure plot advancement and, you know, to learn all about something, you're not really going to get a huge amount. There's a lot of distraction and a lot of slowness to really find out, okay, wait, who are these people? What is the relationship going on here, and how did it come to be?
Well, ultimately then, did it work for you, Stephen?
I really loved it. I love everything Herzog does, I think. It's a 4 out of 5 for me. It's a beautiful, strange and kind of touching commentary on loneliness in Japan and in urban life. And yeah, I just love Herzog. So it's 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5 from you. And the cherry blossoms are beautiful as well.
Yeah,
Sarah.
I mean, there's some beautiful aerial footage as well. So they're lovely cinematic flourishes, which are sort of palate cleansers as well. So it's not just oddities and confusion and discomfort. Beautiful soundtrack as well. So I'd say it's a 3 out of 5 for me because of the bizarre elements and a little bit of a slow speed.
Right, so it didn't quite your boat as it did Stephen's. Right, let us move on then to The Old Guard. Based on a graphic novel, Stephen, of the same name, an action thriller about a group of immortal warriors who have acted as altruistic mercenaries throughout history. Now, that sounds like a fairly promising premise, doesn't it, Stephen?
It sounds hugely exciting, Sean. I was very much looking forward to it, but unfortunately, it's not actually as exciting as it sounds. Now, there's some really fun elements to it, but the film just doesn't kind of It just doesn't hit it off with what it's trying to do. So Charlize Theron plays Andromache, or Andy the Scythian, and she is an ancient warrior who's the first person to become immortal. And as time passes, she's joined by others, played by Luca Marinelli, has Nikki, Marwan Kenzari, Matthias Schoenaerts, who some people might know, the Belgian actor, is in there as well. So there's a really quite good cast.
Yes.
And this team of immortals is, sorry, Sean, they're kind of set up by the CIA who want their secrets. And one of the CIA characters is played by Chiwetel Ejiofor. And they're in cahoots with Big Pharma. So basically, the characters go on the run after they've been set up, and they try and recruit a new immortal, played by Kiki Layne. That character's called Niall Freeman.
Yeah, that's a very important.
They go on the run.
That's a very important point, really, isn't it, Sarah? Where the Kiki Layne character is, because initially we see a scene where all of the immortals are killed, and they all stand back up because they can do that. That's the special power they have. And then we're in a real life situation in Afghanistan with the Kiki Layne character. And she gets killed, and you think, oh, this is different. But then it's not different.
No, and actually, it's a big amount of trouble for her. She's working in the US Marine, and it's very spooky for a lot of people how she almost dies and then comes back to life without a scar. And so one power, you know, throughout the film, we kind of learn additional powers the Immortals have in a way that kind of deviates from the perhaps more interesting elements of the story. But so we learn that all the Immortals can communicate through dreams, sort of. So they all go to sleep at night and they dream of...
Sort of.
I mean, there's a lot of sort of power in this film. Like, can they do that? Oh, I guess they can. So this character, Niall, played by Kiki Layne, you may recognise from If Beale Street Could Talk, she is dreamed of, and all the Immortals come and rescue her. Niall has to become part of this group. And that's quite an interesting element, because now she has to leave her family behind, because if the family were to realise who she were, they could sell her to Big Pharma. You know, she has to become used to being disconnected and being a murdering machine and never ever dying and coming to terms with that. And that's an interesting component.
Andromache the City, and I love the fact that Charlize Theron's character shortens that to Andy. It's a great way to say very difficult name. Well, here is Andromache the City, and explaining to Kiki Layne's character, Niall, what has happened to her.
Who are you?
I lead a group of Immortals. An army, I guess. Soldiers. Fighters like you. Look. You've got questions, kid. I get it. You want answers? Get back in the car.
Interesting that it really puts Charlize Theron and Kiki Layne centre stage here. It gives the two big action roles to the two female leads.
Absolutely. And that's, like I was mentioning earlier, is really interesting. Like, how do you learn, how do you come to terms with a big part of your life, and how do you mentor someone into being a killing machine when you're constantly on the run from Big Pharma? So that's rather than that being something which is, you know, develops emotional gravitas or a level of interest, it really is just about badass lines, like you heard there, like sort of patronising talk, referring to her as kid, and those sort of lines, and like explosions and then dubstep and then not looking behind you, really. You know, it just sort of goes into trite action cliches rather than what is an interesting story that, of course, like, is an action film and is in some ways a thriller. So in that way, it was a disappointment.
I think that's...
Go ahead,
Stephen. You hit the nail on the head there. Look, trite action cliches is exactly what this is. And like, Netflix are now churning out this kind of movie, you know, a couple of them almost every month. And they follow a formula to a T, which is throw a bucket of money at some big stars, cast a group of international actors to appeal to the widest possible audience, shoot it cheaply, and, you know, adapt cheaper or lesser known properties. And without Charlize Theron, this film would be kind of pretty pretty soulless and empty. But along the lines of movies like Bright, Extraction, Triple Frontier, if anyone knows what I'm talking about, on Netflix, that these big movies that have big stars but are ultimately, you know, completely empty.
What about the pharma aspect of the story? Stephen Merrick is the character here, played by Harry Melling, which we'll all know from Harry Potter.
From Harry Potter. He's Dudley Dursley. He's grown up and more of an asshole than ever.
Yeah, he's a big, very nasty bit of work.
The youngest, what does he call himself? Yeah, I'm the youngest pharma billionaire. And it's like, wow, we hate you already. Well done, director.
Which I guess is the point, though. We are supposed to hate him, but there's no grey area here. Maybe around the character of Copley. We'll come back to that. Yeah. But why did Big Pharma, what did Big Pharma want to do
here? Big Pharma want to have a drug which will make people never die. I guess it's sort of, an immortality drug, and they're very interested to find out what sort of DNA these people have. And rather doing it in an ethical way with the consent of the participants and working together for something mutually beneficial for humanity, they capture them and they steal their tissue, which is not very nice. So then, as you mentioned, that Copley, the CIA agent, who's played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, he had been, you know, his wife had died sadly by cancer. He believes this drug could save her. So then he captures these people and then is like, wait a second, capturing people may not be so great, and I have ethical concerns about this. So there's a bit of a grey area there.
So here's a scene between Copley, the Chiwetel Ejiofor character, and Stephen Merrick, the Harry Melling character. And Melling wanted to capture all of them and get them into his compound and do his experimentations, but they didn't quite manage to get all of them.
You've seen my research. Now you know they're for real.
What about the hard proof? Blood, tissue, bone, DNA.
Recovering an uncontaminated sample of the site proved impossible.
But you promised me hard proof.
There was an unanticipated amount of carnage. Footage.
No, the footage is a $2 million snuff film. It doesn't give her the how. I need all of them, Copley.
Oh, I think I can get you one.
No, not one. All.
These are extraordinary individuals. They are extremely resistant to capture.
There we go. That's Stephen Merrick, played by Harry Melling, and James Copley, played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, in a scene there from the old guard, the Charlize Theron. She's an executive producer on this as well, which is part of the thing. But there's a whole other backstory going on about somebody she fought with way back in the mists of time,
yeah,
who was thrown down into the sea.
Yeah. And
the whole film seems to be...
Oh, yeah. Oh, by the way, sorry, get ready for a franchise. This isn't going to be a once-off. Like, I couldn't find anything confirmed there was a franchise, but presumably the money will be there, seeing as she's the producer and she's, you know,
this is definitely going to run and run, I think.
Yeah. And it clearly leads up to that in a way that is just so contrived and irrelevant to the rest of the film. It just, like, makes you want to roll your eyes so far back into your head, like your retina's detached.
Yeah, to 2 hours and 5 minutes that this film is, and about the 2 hours and 4 minutes in, you get the setup for the second film in the franchise, and it seems as if it was the whole film just to set us up to watch the rest of the franchise. But what about the action sequences? Were they not worth it? Were they not well done, the fight sequences, Stephen?
I thought that action, this is why, if you want to watch a film like this, you want to watch it for amazing action sequences. This was kind of so prosaic and dull. It kind of surprised me, actually, that it felt a bit like I was watching a TV movie from 10 years ago sometimes. I didn't think there was a huge amount of money spent on some of those sequences. There wasn't a lot of CGI. Not that we need CGI, but perhaps in a film like this, you might. So I felt a little bit outdated there. And Gina Prince-Bythewood is a good director, but maybe she's not a director of kind of films about immortal mercenaries throughout history who can do kung fu and stuff.
And the other thing we need partners to say, because you think if they're immortal, sure, there's no nothing's at stake, but in fact they're only immortal for a period
of
time.
They're immortal, kind of.
Immortal
until they die.
Okay, yeah. Right. Stars from you, Stephen.
2 out of 5. Go and watch Highlander instead.
Okay, and Sarah?
Yeah, same. 2 out of 5. Took even 45 minutes to decide what the film was actually about, and then gave us flat action.
Yeah, a little bit less might have got. We've got there quicker. We might have been less annoyed. Let us move on then to Blackwater Abyss. And this is a croc horror set in Australia. Latest cinema release. Unique genre, one would think, but believe it or not, this is the second croc horror film this year. Crawl was released last year. You think this is crocodilist, this movie?
Oh,
do
yes.
you, Sarah?
Anti-crocodile propaganda of the first order, absolutely. No. So what this film really is about is about the cinema's disregard for the clever animal that is the crocodile. So what this is about is that thankfully, the Northern Territories of Australia have banned shark culling. Crocodile numbers. So crocodile numbers have increased. A group of 4 dunderheaded humans wade in to crocodile territory, serve themselves up on a platter as hors d'oeuvres for this crocodile. And the crocodile dares, you know, sniff at them, and then this film is about how terrible that is and how we should feel for the humans. But I tell you what, they're shallow humans with nothing else going on, foolhardy as well, descend without proper into this cave without proper equipment, without telling where they are. So I say, go. I'm pro shark here. I would, of course, give me crocodile.
Let's have a listen to this. Is a kind of a little selection from the trailer, which kind of gives you the basic thing that Sarah has just told us.
What do you reckon?
Let's check it out.
What'd I tell you?
This is incredible, huh?
Hey.
What the hell is that? The cave's filling up.
The river must have burst its banks.
We're going to be in the water whether we like it or not.
And no one knows we're down here, right?
Does anyone have service?
It's only a short swim.
We got to swim out of here.
Did you miss something?
You cannot get in that
water. What choice do I have? Crocs are territorial. He's not going to be happy till we're all gone.
Whatever you do, don't splash.
Do not move a muscle.
No! Bernard Herrmann will be looking for money for that little bit of Psycho at the end there. The music plays, does all the work, let's face it. But my favourite bit, I think, within that particular clip there was when one of the characters asks, whatever number of feet they are down under the ground, anybody got service? Has your mobile phone got coverage and we can phone for help?
Idiots.
Yeah, it's fairly formulaic stuff, Stephen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these people, you really don't feel for them at all. I found myself hoping the Crocs would get on with the job because they go caving with no caving gear. They're wearing, you know, check shirts and T-shirts. It's also not cold underground, where crocodiles presumably wouldn't be able to function without the light of the sun. There's very little meat in the script. The characters are characterless, and the you know, pardon the pun, but the story lacks any kind of bite.
Woohoo!
So yeah, I kind of agree with Sarah. I felt like the Crocs themselves don't get much screen time, so I would imagine crocodiles all over the world won't be very happy with that.
Yeah.
And there's not very many scary moments either, which is what you want from this movie.
Yeah,
I'm a big fan of croc horrors, I have to say.
Chekhov tells us that if you have a gun in Act One, you have to shoot the gun in Act Two. They set things up appallingly in this, you know. In the first sequence, we're told about this torch will last for 120 hours. Well, that's going to run out of battery, isn't it, after 120 hours? And also one of the guys, make sure to bring your asthma inhaler with you, so we know there's going to be a problem with the asthma inhaler.
Yeah.
Join the dots plotting here, Sarah?
Oh my gosh, to the nth degree. So we just, I mean, there's 10 minutes at the beginning, which is sort of meant to set up us up to the characters, you know, create a warmth and perhaps some plot points which will be developed. And instead, they all just sort of like make these minds and ends, be like, yep, in remission from cancer, pregnant, have asthma, having relationship troubles. And it's like, all right, down the cave you go, you know. And then we're like, okay, well, something's presumably going to happen to that. And then not a whole lot does. It's like, oh, I'm having an asthma attack. And it's like, okay, yeah, great.
Yeah, well, but despite all of that, you know, say a wet Sunday afternoon or a wet Sunday evening, would it not entertain you for an hour and a half? It doesn't outstay its welcome. It's a good hour and a half, tight, over, except little tail at the end, perhaps, that could have been cut. But yeah, you know, it does. Doesn't overstay its welcome.
No, it's so slow. I mean, like, there's just nothing in there.
And you think,
even like, it's really slow at getting started, developing. I mean, as Stephen mentioned, it's not even scary. Okay, like, so actually, John, you know, Werner Herzog on the show last night was saying there's a problem with the films that get funded, you know, funds that are about the human condition that are deep. They don't get funded. Instead, what gets funded is ones with CGI and great computer graphics. And like, this film is the problem with filmmaking. That these are the kind of films that get but get made and get attention. I mean, like, this is a main option people have for going to cinema rather than something else. So in that regard, like, and also the CGI isn't even good. Like, it's like really it's actually funny that people that they expect us
some
to believe
some of the crocodiles are
mad.
Sorry, Sarah. So,
go ahead, Stephen.
Sorry. I was going to say some of the crocodiles are kind of Jaws level bad in terms of, you know, the shark in Jaws. They're kind of little models just going across the top of the water. And I know they look a bit like that, but it looks cheap. It really
and glowing
cheap.
Eyes as well. And the wounds they're meant to have. Like, it fondly misunderstands how crocodiles work.
Right. And the other thing is the shark in Jaws has John Williams music underneath it. So therefore, it's absolutely brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Stars from you, first of all, Sarah.
It's one. It gets a point for being like funny but bad. So, I mean, if you want to not watch something, or maybe just have a laugh at how terrible some things can be, watch
it. Okay, you didn't enjoy it, clearly. And Stephen?
I won as well. And I would say, like, you know, go and check out something like Lake Placid if you want to see a good croc movie.
All right. That's Sarah Taffin-Guire and Stephen Boyd speaking to us this evening about Blackwater Abyss, The Old Guard and Family Romance LLC. 29 minutes past 7 on Thursday night's Arena. We spoke to Lenny Abrahamson recently about the Arts Council's advisory group report in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. On the day of that report, which was called Survive, Adapt, Renew, on the day it was published, the government invested €25 million extra to support arts organisations through the Arts Council. But whatever way you look at it, COVID-19 certainly has had a devastating effect on the arts in Ireland. Normally at this time of year, Arena would have relocated for the week to Galway for the International Arts Festival. And the Galway Arts Festival not only provides the venue for live music gigs in the Big Top Theatre, theatre in various venues, galleries and a host of visual arts exhibitions, it is also a commissioner and creator of arts events that frequently go on tour nationally and internationally. To see what the lay of the land is in Galway right now, I'm joined from our Galway studio by the artistic director of the Galway International Arts Festival, Paul Fahey. If all had gone to plan and if there had been no COVID-19, what would you be doing today, Paul?
Well, good evening, Sean. It's nice to hear your voice and nice to be on the show. It's tonight actually would have been one of our first theatre previews nights. The festival was due to kick off on the 13th of July, which is next Monday, and we would have been opening a gallery with an amazing array of exhibitions on this coming Sunday. As I said, tonight would have been the night for a couple of previews of our own co-productions. But alas, COVID got hold no more than everywhere else and put a bit of a dent in our plans for that. So it's been busy for the last while, kind of trying to, you know, unproduce everything that we had planned and trying to postpone things and reschedule things for next year and trying to keep teams together, et cetera, et cetera. So it's been kind of a frantically busy time, but in a very different kind of a way.
Not at Verb, I think you would expect to find yourself using very often to unproduce something and to therefore refer to yourself as an unproducer.
It's such a horrible term. I hate it. But yeah, and I have to say, it's been like the last few weeks as an organisation, it's been and certainly I've been pining on a personal level as well, but we've all been just a little bit adrift in that, you know, you're not there in the middle of something major that's kind of being created and evolving. We would have been building a gallery like we did last year that took us kind of 10 weeks to transform an amazing building in Anpus. We'd have been getting productions up and running. We'd have been welcoming artists from Ireland and all over the world arriving into Galway. It's a beautiful sunny evening this evening in Galway, so there would have been a great deal of excitement and fun around town as well. And the FLA, of course, is on virtually now. The film FLA that would have been creating a great buzz around town. So it just feels like a very, very different time. So yeah, unproducing is not the most pleasant a task because you're disappointing so many people by telling them that what you'd planned can't go ahead, and you're trying to rearrange and reschedule.
Yeah, well, we'll come back to maybe what you're doing with some of those rearrangements and reschedulings later. But I mentioned that not only obviously you're talking about stuff coming in to Galway, but you also commission work, and Incantata, which was the dramatisation of the Paul Muldoon poem with Stanley Townsend performing, that was one of your shows, and it was actually doing a New York run, wasn't it, when the pandemic struck?
It was indeed. Yeah, that was a Go International Arts Festival and Jen Coppinger production that had premiered in Galway in 2018, and we'd been to the Gate Theatre in Dublin just before Christmas last year. And yes, we were having a great run at the Irish Repertory Theatre, which is an off-Broadway house in Manhattan in New York. And it had gotten an amazing array of reviews, lovely New York Times critics pick, etc, etc. So, and it was incredible. I mean, it was such an amazing opening night over there, and with the support of Culture Ireland, thanks to them, of course, as always, for getting us there. But yeah, I mean, little did one think, you know, a few weeks later I was back in Ireland and obviously, you know, touching base with the company every day, and then word had gotten out that there was a couple of COVID cases from some staff in Broadway houses, and there was a couple of deep cleansing that went on there after theatres before audiences went back in. And then very quickly after that, Broadway announced it was closing, and that was followed kind of pretty quickly, I think it was 2 or 3 days later, by Off-Broadway. The Off-Broadway League recommended closure of all the other Off-Broadway houses, of which we were one. So yes, there was a mad scurry of trying to, you know, arrange new flights, etc, etc, for all of the company to get them back home. So thankfully we only missed we closed 3 days early, so we missed 4 shows, which was a pity, but the company were all fantastic, and it was, you know, great to see Paul Muldoon's beautiful words on the New York stage.
But then you're back in Galway at that stage, you've managed to get the company all back home and everybody's safe and sound. But you're heading towards, you're looking at July and it's March. What kind of thoughts were going around in your head at that time? When did the unproducing start to rear its ugly head?
Well, I suppose, you know, I remember sitting at a board meeting actually with my colleagues, and we were just chatting to, you know, to our board about like final plans for the festival and all that. And we had a conversation about, you know, did we think that the festival would be top, which has, you know, 3,000 plus capacity, did we think that was going to go ahead? You know, would crowds of that size be able to get congregate in one place? And you know, then day by day things just were changing at such a rate. And I suppose it was probably like the middle of March, you know, before, I think it was this, just before St. Patrick's Day was when the Taoiseach made the announcement about everything kind of going into lockdown. Mm. But, you know, I think it was on the 13th of March, whatever the days were. But within a few days, things had progressed so rapidly. And, you know, going into 20, we're doing that great Carricola project out in Connemara, which I was very blessed to see. It was quite a spectacular thing. But yeah, things just came tumbling down, yeah, for everybody fairly quickly after that. But even then, Sean, like, it was still, you know, it was still hard to know. That was March, and July still seemed a long way off. So we didn't know then. We were obviously, doubt was beginning to creep in, and, you know, we were eternal optimists, but we were great pragmatists at the same time. And then you were trying to reimagine shows. You know, you mentioned that, like, we co-produced a lot of our own work, and there were shows that were meant to have, like, much longer lives beyond Galway and tour both in Ireland and internationally. And we were looking at, well, you know, Did we think we'd be able to reimagine the timeline for some of those shows? So we spent quite a lot of time looking at things like that and looking at various different scenarios. Yeah, well, and then it wasn't until the end of April when we knew in our heart and souls that it wasn't possible, and that's when we had to postpone.
And one of those big shows was Pat McCabe's Breakfast on Pluto. That was to have had quite a long life, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was our co-production with the great Landmark Lambert Productions in Dublin, Anne Clark, who we have a very long history of co-producing work with and touring. We had showcased that last year, just the first half of the show during the festival, to, you know, great response. It was hugely exciting, and that was to have quite a long life. We'd made an announcement in March about that, you know, heading to Dublin and Birmingham and London, and that was going to run through to the end of November. So that was an awful shame to see something like that happen, to, you know, be postponed for the next year or so.
And was it a case, could you make, or can you even be in a position now to make the decision, say, yeah, that can go ahead, providing that everything gets back to normal? Can you start to put dates on things like that, or is it much too early for that?
Everything is kind of unique, every particular thing. You know, there was another show that we hadn't announced, so I can't give details off. It was also meant to have a very long life beyond Galway. So we're busy, you know, trying to recreate a timeline for those. And obviously, everybody's affected in a different kind of a way. You know, we're traditionally set with, you know, our 2 weeks in July every year, or a little bit more. Other theatres will be affected in different kind of ways, and different countries and different jurisdictions will be affected in different ways. You know, nobody really knows when London or New York or whatever might reopen properly. So we're trying to reschedule all those as best we can. We have been very fortunate to actually be able to reschedule every single one of the Heineken Big Top gigs that we had advertised and that were on sale. There were eight concerts that we had announced by the time that the lockdown had happened. And thankfully, all of those we've managed to reschedule, every one of those, to another date next year. All details on our website there, gaf.ie. So that's fantastic. You know, when we started doing that, I kind of thought maybe one or two of them might fall by the wayside, because, you know, with some of the bigger international acts who might be, you know, you might be part of a European tour or whatever, they obviously have to organise gigs in a lot of other countries. So we've been very lucky that that all those are in place and happening in 2021.
Yeah, because I think that isn't the Broadway plan is for the spring of 2021, and Britain, they're also saying in Britain, I heard reports over the weekend on the BBC about this idea that, you know, nothing is going to move until 2021. That's a long time. I mean, if a theatre was dark, as they say, if there was nothing happening in the theatre for a couple of weeks, we'd be saying, God, it's dark for quite a while, isn't it? We're looking at theatres being dark for almost 9, 10, 11, maybe 12 months. How can that survive?
Perhaps even longer. That's a big, big worry. I mean, I was chatting to a New York colleague just the other day. And like, it's the bigger shows that I think are expected to come back to Broadway first. I actually would have thought it might have been the other way around. But, you know, the Lion Kings and the Phantom of the Opera type of shows, the bigger bankers, and the more kind of artistically led works are going into rehearsal in June and opening in September. So that is a long way off. But to answer your question, I mean, like, how do things like that survive and with huge difficulty? And that's why it was so welcome to hear the government's 20 million to the Arts Council and the extra 5 million very recently. And hats off to to everybody who's campaigned hard for that, and the Arts Council, you know, being led by, you know, a great new team with Maureen Kennelly and Kevin Rafter. So it's fantastic that that commitment is there. And I think, you know, what we really will require and what the industry will require to survive are things like, you know, emergency financial support, which hopefully will come from that 20 million to ensure that, you know, organisations don't go down and don't close. And also then for individuals, for artists, for all of the art workers, for all of the crew, for, you know, there's so many people involved to make a show, make an exhibition, make any kind of an event happen. Mm. And so many of those people are freelancers, and, you know, are without the comfort of a full-time job or whatever. So, like, so those COVID support wage systems, I think it's really key that they stay in place for the foreseeable until we see how we get back.
But then we had the extraordinary statement from Judi Dench that I think frightened the living daylights out of all of us when she talked about theatre being dead. How is it? Should the money that we're talking about there, should it be used literally to keep projects and people on life, what is almost life support machines, really, isn't it? You know, something that tides them through this period of nothing happening.
Absolutely. I mean, it was hugely sad to hear Judi Dench make those comments, and especially when she's such a great, you know, a great woman of the theatre all of her life. I know she became probably a bit better known for her film and the wider world in later years, but, you know, she's absolutely theatre is in her bones, and I thought it was so upsetting hearing her so vulnerably say that she didn't see the theatre ever returning in her lifetime, which is tragic. But I think as well, you know, with that, some of that 20 million, which I know is going to be earmarked by the Arts Council for things like artist bursaries and project bursaries, etc. You know, it will be a big job of work to get all that stuff rolled out and get all the bursaries in place and the details in place and the planning systems and allow people time to apply, allow the bursaries to be decided on, and then more importantly for the work to be made and to keep people going. Because, you know, the one other thing as well, you know, I think it's important to say, money like that, it isn't just grants, it isn't just people that are there with their hands out saying, you know, give us some support. Like, it's investment in a fantastic industry for which we are celebrated and known the world over.
But there will be some people who say, 20 million, 25 million, that's a lot of money. Is it enough? Will it be enough to actually keep this industry alive?
First of all, I think, you know, the arts are very underfunded in Ireland generally when you make comparisons with the rest of Europe. It is fantastic that extra 20 million has been secured for the Arts Council, and that'll bring their figure up to, I think, 100,000 this year. That should be an absolute baseline figure. But again, I mean, I can only say, maybe speak directly from our own viewpoint from Galway International Arts Festivals. We get about 15 or 16% of our overall turnover from the council. That's our model. You know, we rely very heavily on box office, like 48%, and then other support from private donors, et cetera, and sponsorship, et cetera. But for every €1 that we get off a grant is, which I see as an investment, we return €38 back into the economy. So I think that's excellent bang for buck, and that's just one example. I won't go into detail of everything.
But the other side of that is, Paul, that, you know, if you're looking at that 100 million that comes from state coffers, if you like, and you're talking that's a small part of the money that actually finances it, but, and you're looking for sponsorship, will businesses be in a position to sponsor arts organisations, or are they going to feel we have to survive here as well?
I think it'll be incredibly difficult. You know, we've had some lovely messages of support from people, and we're chatting to others about hoping to be able to maintain our partnerships with them. But obviously, everybody is kind of in the same boat. And so, as I said, like, for an organisation like ourselves, who has, you know, 15 or 16% of our turnover being from the council, that's a huge amount of, like, the massive reliance on box office, 48%, which is a huge reliance. So, and with no tickets to sell because we can't put on events, that's a huge gap. But I think it is going to be, you know, very difficult for everything to get back to, you know, where we're at. But I do think as well, it's important to say, Sean, that, you know, never before maybe has it been as obvious as to how important culture is to all of us individually and collectively as a nation. You know, we all relied massively on our favourite books and our favourite music and our favourite, you know, everything being streamed or whatever during the whole lockdown period. And, you know, I mean, it was great to hear on Taoiseach Leo Varadkar quote from Seamus Heaney and quote from Dermot Kennedy and other more popular culture. But so it's like, it's absolutely part of our DNA, and it's what we're absolutely known for worldwide. Yeah. And, you know, you said at the top of the show, but, you know, we produce and co-produce work that often travels internationally. And even going back 10 or 12 years after the economy collapsed in 2008, I mean, it was fascinating to see, you know, the amount of stuff that was still written back then on Irish culture. And it was such a carrier. And, you know, and it never failed us as a people. Right. And it's not going to now, but it needs the support and the continued support to make that work.
And let's finish on the positive note that you have something planned. There will be events in September.
Yeah, we'll be making a full announcement. I can't give you too many details this evening, Sean, but we'll be making a full announcement on a programme of events that we're running in the autumn, as you say, which will be very exciting. And but, you know, part of that will be, some of the stuff will be outdoors, including the great John Gerard's Murray Pavilion, which is our GOI 2020 project.
Great.
And that's a big flagship project in and of itself. But we'll have other projects that will be for like a live audiences that will also be streamed. And we're working very hard at the moment on protocol for how we can comfortably and with great assurance bring audiences back into theatre spaces and bring artists back together to create the work in the first place. So we look forward to making that announcement later on this month.
Hearing a lot of optimism there in your voice, Paul.
Well, listen, I'm an eternal optimist, but I think as well, you know, we work in a creative industry and we are creative people, and we will find ways of bringing people back together to make the work and for people to experience the work. And that's where the magic always happens. But in doing that, it's not going to happen overnight. It'll take time. And that's where the support is really required.
All right. That's Paul Fahey there, the Artistic Director of the Galway International Arts Festival. Optimistic note to end with, and I'm glad to hear that. And you can find out details about the events that will be happening throughout the autumn on the website, as Paul mentioned, giaf.ie. Britain's preeminent State of the Nation author Amanda Craig has just published her ninth novel, The Post-Brexit Tale, The Golden Rule. The story sees two women on a train plan to murder each other's husbands, and Amanda joins me now. Amanda, people who know Patricia Highsmith, people who know Alfred Hitchcock, and you acknowledge this yourself in the book, as indeed does one of the characters, read this book, they'll be aware that there is a story out there about two men who plan to do something similar with their wives.
Absolutely. Well, actually, in the original Patricia Highsmith, it's a wife and a father.
All right.
But Hitchcock changed the story.
Right.
Yes. No, absolutely. I mean, this all grew out of the previous novel, The Lie of the Land, and the research that I did with various women friends who had found out that their husbands were cheating on them and were embroiled in the agonies of divorce. And they all said to me one after another, you know, it would be so much easier to be a widow. And the third time I heard one of them say that, I thought, my God, this is a novel. I've got to write this. And so the idea, of course, of the Highsmith then occurred to me. And because I live partly in Devon, I'm very familiar with the train that goes from Paddington Station to Penzance in Cornwall. And I thought, well, obviously it should start here. So it all grew out of that.
Yeah, and Hannah and Ginny are the two women who find themselves on the train and find themselves making their various plans. But to be fair, particularly in the case of Hannah, she's in a very difficult situation. And Jake, with whom she has a young daughter, the treatment here, it kind of speaks to a lot of stuff that we heard about during the whole lockdown period about abusive relationships and women trapped in abusive relationships. Hannah is in exactly that situation.
Yes, she is not just being, as it were, starved out by her literally entitled husband Jake, but he's also hitting her and threatening her. And it's a really, really ultimate toxic marriage. But it's not the only toxic marriage in this novel. There's something that we can't reveal. But,
yes,
you know, Ginny's story is not entirely true, let us say.
Yeah. And there are other characters in there. Is it a neighbour of Hannah's as well, who is dealing with a very difficult relationship?
Yes, she's a Muslim woman who's run away from her husband, again with a small child, and she lives in absolute terror of ever being found by him. That story, I mean, what the awful thing is, Sean, that all the stories in this book and all the awful things, except the very, very kind of dramatic climax are real. They're all based on real stories of real people.
I wondered to what extent you really, because this would have been written before lockdown, obviously, if we're getting it published, you know, right now. So that whole, the news reports around abusive relationships and women trapped in houses during that lockdown period, which became such a concern for so many people. That aspect wasn't there. But clearly the aspect of abusive relationships and women trapped was something that you wanted to write about.
Yes, I mean, unfortunately, I think it's always there. I mean, I was writing this as the whole Me Too scandal was exploding, first in America and then here. And I think, you know, it's so shocking. And people who have never experienced abuse or known someone who is abused find it often quite hard to believe, but it's a real thing. And I should add that it's not only women who are abused. One third of all abuse victims are men. And they're so ashamed of this that, you know, they don't speak about it as much as women are now speaking up. But it's a general problem that, you know, when you get these terrible relationships in which one person achieves ascendancy over the other, you can get this ghastly form of torture. So that's the background to the novel, but it's also, I hope, exciting and funny, and it's based on the fairy tale of Beauty and the Beast.
I've got to ask you about that aspect. How that? Because stories are hugely important in the novel. Hannah herself, your character, she's a great reader, although she kind of finds the reading a bit of a trap. We might come back to that, or she's a bit of a torture in some ways. But she's a great reader, and the tale of Beauty and the Beast, and perhaps its Greek predecessor, I think, is probably what inspired you more than anything else.
Yes, the Greek myth of Cupid and Psyche, because that also contains in it this astonishing thing of Psyche's sisters persuading her to murder the bridegroom who she's never seen. And luckily, Psyche smuggles in not just a dagger, but also a candle. And when she sees that the man who's the creature in her bed isn't a monster, but the most beautiful man in the world, she immediately falls in love with him, only to have him snatched away. And I've always thought this was the most wonderful idea that, you know, look, people tell a lot of lies about each other, sadly, and even to themselves. But when we really see each other as we are with love, I think everything is changed. So, you know, this is a story that has at its heart not violence and hate, but love and the miracle that love can bring about.
Yeah, and that there is a real possibility of transformation, and that's something that I think holds the reader throughout. So I don't want to give the sense that it's a big, dark piece of work, but there's no getting away from some of the very dark sides of life that you look at, not least of which is poverty. And poverty, particularly in Cornwall, you really give us a sense of, in the post-Brexit world, the type of devastation that has happened in essentially rural areas like Cornwall, although rural Cornwall is different than rural Ireland in many ways.
Well, actually, I think that there are quite a lot of similarities. I mean, they're both incredibly beautiful places, especially along the coast. And people get deceived when they come as tourists into thinking that because they're beautiful, they must be easy or comfortable and everybody must be living a happy life. Whereas, sadly, the reverse is true. And what's happened in Cornwall in particular is that pretty much all the coastal housing has been bought up by rich people and second homers who live there for perhaps 6 weeks a year. And the indigenous people basically have nowhere to live and very few jobs. And this is very kind of horrifying the more you discover it. I should put my hand up at this point and say that I myself live half and half in London and Devon. But the bit of Devon where we bought, I mean, we could afford it because it's one of the poorest places. It's inland. It's not somewhere where, you know, this kind of person is going to want to live. It's you know, we basically bought a ruin and saved it. But what was very shocking was discovering the extent of poverty that exists in England, because perhaps as many Irish people do, you tend to assume that England is quite a wealthy place. And it is wealthy, very, very wealthy in places like London. But you go out into the countryside away from the home counties and it's quite a different story. And that was what inspired The Lie of the Land before this. And is also what's inspired The Golden Rule, that absolute shock of, you know, poverty of expectation. And these fantastic people, because, you know, somehow they are struggling and making a living and you know, keeping their heads just above water. Of course, what's going to happen now with the virus is another question. I mean, are they, because, of course, the Cornish in particular are deeply, deeply fearful of getting this huge influx, not just of tourists and tourist money, which they desperately need, but infection. So that's a story to be continued.
As you start talking about the pandemic there, it strikes me that, you know, first of all, is it possible right now? This is quite definitely a post-Brexit novel. There's no question about that, I think. In fact, Hannah has a great theory around how Cornwall might specifically deal with that, and I might come back to it because it's such a Celtic side to it that I love it. But I'm wondering, is it possible to even write a story in a novel in Britain at the moment without it having post-Brexit all over it? And to follow, well, answer me that bit first.
Well, I think it's possible. I mean, it does feel like riding this giant wave that's continually rising and toppling and might drown you at any moment. But I think it's such a kind of horrific situation. You know, it's divided so many people, even within families, as a debate. I mean, I am an absolutely ardent Remainer, and I wish I could get a European passport to at least have some sort of exit plan. But it's a nightmare, this, that part of Britain has wished upon itself. But in Cornwall, having said all that, the way that people feel such deep anger, you know, it's all focused on the EU, what's happened to the fishing industry there. They blame it for the way that, you know, fishermen no longer have enough quotas, you know, all these things that sound terribly dreary, but have real and terrible effects
on people's lives.
Again, with things like farming, yep, people's lives. And it's the same with farming in Devon. And, you know, I think, you know, people just, that there's a very alarming thing in Britain now of people just not reading proper newspapers, not listening to proper radio programs, or, you know, they're just getting it all off the internet, which is, of course, an absolute cauldron of lies.
Well, you certainly need to know. You need to know who and what you're reading. I'm wondering, to the extent that Brexit seems to have to be feeding into everything, can you see how the pandemic will feed into everything? Is it inevitable again in the next year or two that art will have to address that in the way in Britain it has had to address Brexit?
I think art will have to address it, but I think that it will have to address it, as it were, indirectly, because, I mean, even Boccaccio, when he wrote the Decameron, it took 5 years. I think you need a bit of distance in time. I mean, I'm writing a new novel at the moment, which is about three old ladies, and it's very much affected by the fact that the virus attacked the elderly as well as the poor and BAME people and all of that. You know, it's very, very interesting. I mean, it's thrown up so many of the deep, deep fissures and flaws in our society that, of course, for a novelist, it's completely fascinating. I mean, as a novelist, you're always divided between the person who has to live in life, who's appalled and agonised. And I'm afraid the novelist who sees these catastrophes and somewhat rubs their hands because, you know, a novel needs drama, and you could not get drama more terrible and gripping than this.
Yeah, right.
I mean, we're all exhausted by it, but nevertheless, it's the great event of our lifetimes.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. So, and we didn't get to Hannah's reasons for why Leave was voted in Cornwall, which has to do with poverty, but I love the idea that she kind of links Cornwall with Scotland, Wales and Ireland as Celtic cousins in a possible solution there, so people can read it and find out more. That's Amanda Craig. Thanks for speaking to us this evening.